Thank you very much for the invitation to present this paper to you today. And I guess while this thing is loading up, what we'd like to do is to get people excited about crop rotation research, long-term research, and invite you to consider a career in this, or at least participating in this, because it's exciting, it's important, and certainly I don't need to convince you after our last speaker. Crop rotation studies on the Canadian prairies. This is the gifts. These are the gifts that keep on giving. That's the way we like to call them. Henry Jansen, who you've just met back there, is responsible for the oldest, the earliest long-term rotation studies in the region, which were started in 1912. And Guy Lafond is also, he's in Lethbridge, Alberta, and Guy Lafond is responsible for long-term rotations in Saskatchewan, and both of those have those rotation studies have received a lot of attention in the literature. This is where we are. We're the three provinces in Canada, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, are typically called the Canadian prairies, although we have a little piece of northern British Columbia there. Can you hear me okay? Is this, I'm a long way from the mic, thanks. And we're an extension of the U.S. Great Plains with a variety of soil types ranging from the wetter, shorter season to the dry, semi-arid, dry areas in the south. When we think about crop rotation in North America, we often think about European settlement. And I've selected here something from American history, Thomas Jefferson's crop rotation plan. But in Western Canada, that's actually not completely correct, because our first farmers were Aboriginal people. And in fact, in the 1870s and 80s and 90s, Aboriginal farmers were doing quite well in Canada. They were farming communally, they had machines. Sarah Carter, in her book Lost Harvests, argues that this was destroyed through government policy. 3 acres and a cow is something that maybe perhaps we could have inferred from what the previous speaker was talking, and that philosophy was misused in Canada to force these people through a subsistence existence. And so I just think we should acknowledge that contribution. But yes, European settlers did arrive starting in 18... Well, actually, the region is the first Walmart of North America. Occurred in northern Canada about 300 years ago. It was called the Hudson's Bay Company. Okay, it was a very large, dare I say, monopoly. And so there were gardens as well. Europeans did have gardens, but broad acre agriculture really didn't start until the late 1800s. And this is very nicely articulated in Henry's fascinating paper on peering into the future from a century ago, which you should all read. But, of course, like many areas of the New World, the scientists arrived with the European settlers and were able to document things that these settlers were doing. And there was also a connection to Rothamsted, because being one of the colonies, being involved in that international nutrient transfer, or whatever you called it, which was interesting, Gilbert and Laws made sure that the Western Canadian prairies were sampled. And so in the Rothamsted archives, there are soil samples from Manitoba from 1882. And again, thanks to Henry for bringing all this information together in that fascinating paper. And they were quite struck by the high surface soil organic matter in the soils in this region. Now, initially, the scientists focused on short-term goals, things like summer fallow, for example, which they stumbled upon in dry years, recognizing that it had advantages. But monitoring the system allowed those same scientists to see that summer fallow might be connected to this soil organic matter loss, which was disturbing. And so concern over soil decline was voiced early on by the scientists who were there. There was a search for permanence, and that, I think if I read between the lines of the history, was probably one of the reasons why the long-term crop rotation studies were first established, to find out what was the potential and also what was the permanence of agriculture in this region. And so crop rotation studies were started in about 1910, although the one at Lethbridge is, I believe, 1912? 11, okay, so we'll split the difference, thank you. Thank you, Henry. And this is our region, and we had a number of studies which were started in the early part of the last century, and they were funded by the Canadian government. Right now they're managed by Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada, so it's the national government who paid for them. These early studies are located at Lethbridge, in Western Saskatchewan, Indian Head, and Brandon, although the Brandon one no longer exists. Two universities also got into the game, my university in Manitoba here, and the University of Alberta with the Breton plots. And since then, there have been many other studies, and this is really only a snapshot of locations of long-term studies that have come and in some cases gone. Now, I'd just like to take a moment to thank the technicians who looked after these studies over the years, because without their contributions, it wouldn't work. And having one longer-term study myself, I know that without the enthusiasm of the technical staff and the students, some of whom are here, they wouldn't work. And I'd also like to acknowledge all those scientists that have come before us, because it's kind of humbling to talk about these long-term studies, because some of the people are no longer with us either. Just an example of a long-term study. These are the Breton plots. They're still maintained by the University of Alberta, and they are located in northeastern Alberta. And they're established. Most of them are established in 1929, and they're set up very much like Rothamsted. No replication. Large plots. And this is a really fun way to publish your results. These are some results from Breton. Here are the wheat yields for different manuring and fertilization treatments. And these plots taught us something about how to manage acid soils and the importance of liming and the importance of fertilization. Here's the, now we have a very sophisticated bread making labs. This is the way they did it then. These are the rats that are fed the unfertilized grain, and these are the rats that were fed the fertilized grain. And there may be a whole bunch of layers of information in there which we could use if we could find those rats again. The models are validated using long-term studies. And here's some information on nitrate profiles. So let's get back to our story, though. There was a search for permanence. Rotations were started. These rotation studies sometimes contained wheat fallow also contained forage phases because the scientists, some of them, were interested in integrated agriculture, crop livestock, mixed farms. Did it work? Well, to some extent it did, but most of prairie agriculture didn't embrace the mixed model. They embraced fallowing. So that essentially involved extracting the natural capital of the land in the form of nutrients, putting it in the bin and shipping it off to market, sending it off to other parts of the world. And that worked for a while, and when that started having problems because the nutrient supply was exhausted, we started supplementing those nutrients, especially nitrogen, right now we use fossil fuel. And so that brings us to today. The focus of cropping system research has expanded. Number one, we're interested in energy now. We're very interested in energy. Also, farmlands are tightly connected to the broader environment. We know that flows of energy nutrients are tied into global cycles. Biogeochemical cycles are things that agronomists now talk about. And social demands feedback on what happens in the farm. So new questions are perplexing, and to quote Henry, who's an enthusiastic scientist, inviting. And so come on board. Make your students work on, get them out of the lab. Now the other thing, just in as a way of introduction, is to look at the Millennium Ecosystem sort of goals. The three things about ecosystem management which we need to think about is, well, they have to be able to provide food, that's critical, but they're also involved in regulating processes in the ecosystem, and they're also involved in culture. Let's focus on providing. In our region currently, this is about how much energy it takes to provide a crop every year, 7,000 megajoules per hectare per year. It can go up to 10,000, could be as low as 4,000. And much of that is connected with nitrogen fertilizer. And so this begs the question, you know, can we make better use of legumes to reduce reliance on energy-intensive nitrogen? And also, we're interested now in agriculture as a fuel source. What are the efficiencies for producing crops? So these are questions which we can take to our long-term rotations, because we have them. We're lucky to have them in place. For legume-based forage grain studies, I will use here just to illustrate how we can use that to answer these questions. This is the Indian Head 1958 rotation. We are about the same age, and I don't know if the people who established these experiments had any idea that they were going to be used for energy balance studies, but they are. And very briefly, the rotation that includes hay phases with wheat, no nitrogen fertilizer, uses certainly less energy than continuous wheat fertilized, produces that energy more efficiently in terms of kilograms of wheat per megajoule than the standard, but unfortunately is not as productive. At any rate, these studies can help us define what are the parameters. This is our long-term study in Manitoba. Well, it's only 16 years old, so it's still a baby. But it's allowed us also to look at the effect of these perennial forage phases as compared to a straight grain rotation in terms of energy use. Nitrogen fertilizer requirement is less. Total energy use is less. What we do here is it's much more productive, but it's alfalfa calories, but we can put them through ruminants and we can calculate the efficiencies. In this study, what's also striking is that it allows us to address the question of, well, how can we do this with this new notion of organic or low-input agriculture? Well, in our study, we've actually produced more calories in this system organically than we have in this system conventionally. Now, some of those calories are connected with alfalfa, but there are human usable proteins in alfalfa, and what we've done is put those alfalfa through an animal, and we've ended up not only with more energy, but we've used it more efficiently. Unfortunately, this rotation here, without some nutrient recycling, is running out of phosphorus. Okay, so it's good news, but illuminating as well. During this time, we saw a large increase in grain legumes in rotations in our region, and one of the long-term trials that was established back in the late 70s to try to understand what was the benefit of including a legume grain crop with wheat is shown here. So Campbell and Zentner and Biederbeck and Jansen and those researchers have done quite a bit of work. And this one looks at the nitrogen fertilizer required to sustain a continuous wheat system and a wheat-lentil system. And after 10 years, the wheat-lentil system is much more self-sustaining. And remember, we're talking about nitrogen because nitrogen is energy, at least it is right now. Researchers have also been interested in green manure studies. We're in a semi-arid region there, and farmers do fallow. And so what can be done in that fallow phase to supply nitrogen? And if we look, for example, at the Lethbridge studies during this time period, the lentil green manure wheat system with no nitrogen was more productive than the continuous wheat with nitrogen, used much less energy, and produced wheat yield or feedstock, if you want to put it that way, much more efficiently. The results were not as dramatic at Swift Current. So what I'm trying to just articulate here is the long-term studies have been invaluable for energy balance studies. And that's something that we're now asking about. And if we wouldn't have had these studies, I don't think we'd be able to do as credible a job at these questions. Now, we have innovation coming into long-term studies. Instead of tilling and disking green manure crops, we're now rolling them and using less energy to incorporate them. And that brings up an important issue: is how do we incorporate new technology and approaches into long-term studies? And I think we saw an excellent example of that in the previous talk. Another question that farmers are asking is reducing energy with machinery energy and no-till. We've had a no-till revolution in the region. We're about 60% no-till. And some farmers, like this one here in western Manitoba, is using a stripper header and can produce a crop for 7 liters an acre, wheat and canola. So he measured that. Guy Lafond has and colleagues and Bob Zentner have published some work on energy budgets comparing conventional till and no-till, either wheat on cereal stubble or wheat on pea stubble. And there have been some on-farm studies which have shown that no-till reduces energy input. What these researchers found here is in fact that the rotation in this particular study was more important than tillage in reducing energy use. So another example of where a study can help us define what's important. You can see the rotation with pulses here is more productive and more energy efficient than the rotation with cereals. Long-term no-till appears to be having an influence on the nutrient supplying power of the soil. This shows the nitrogen response of wheat in a long-term zero-tillage system over 20 years. And this is the response of wheat to nitrogen in a short-term zero-till system. And this is raising a lot of questions. What's happened to the soils? This is soil that was in a wheat fallow system for 60 years. This is a native prairie, and this is a 22-year no-till soil. Long-term studies allow these soils to be sampled in a meaningful way, and soil microbiologists are now very keen looking at these soils, trying to understand what the soil biodiversity is like. There's even been some cover crop studies that have looked at Jim Sims's self-regenerating medic system, and they're just in their infancy, but I think they might pay off as well. Now, there are new questions about permanence, and so we are lucky to have three organic conventional comparison studies in the region where we can look at the efficiency of that, and there's some surprises there. One of the surprises from Glen Lee is that the organic systems are often and quite consistently higher in micronutrient density, not just owing to the dilution or the concentration effect. So perhaps that's linked to soil biodiversity. We're also interested in regulation. Our landscape is part of the biogeochemical cycle, and we know that there is no such place as a way. And I think this is one of the four laws of ecology. We have pesticides from these areas being picked up here. We have pesticides in the Arctic ice masses through the grasshopper effect. And so intensifying agriculture in one place doesn't mean you're not affecting the environment somewhere else, unfortunately. We see this is work done just close to Winnipeg on eutrophication, where it was found that the phosphorus was really important, more important than the nitrogen. So what can the long-term rotation studies tell us in terms of environmental quality? Well, the Breton plots can tell us something very interesting. Wheat fallow systems leak nitrogen down to 4 meters, or certainly 3 meters, and integrated longer rotations are not as leaky. That's very, very useful. It helps us plan. Who would have thought 50 years ago, that we would be so interested in carbon sequestration measurements in these long-term trials? There certainly have been a lot of surface soil carbon measurements taken. Here's an example of something where researchers looked deeper in the soil profile and found that these longer rotations were sequestering more carbon at depth than the annual rotations. That this is from a 38-year-old crop rotation study. And a couple of our studies include perennial native grass treatments, and I think those might be very useful to use as benchmarks in this carbon cycling work. When it comes to regulation, there may be some gaps in what we're doing. One of them is in the northern part of our region, we have tundra, and that tundra contains a lot of methane. And if the climate should become warmer and that melt, that's going to release the methane, and then perhaps that will be colonized by grasses eventually, which will start sequestering carbon again. We have some sites in Churchill up here. This is the polar bear place. But we haven't paid this a lot of attention, at least as agronomists, and maybe we should be. I wanted also just to highlight biodiversity at a different scale. This is some work that we recently did in our Glenlee plots where we're looking at mycorrhizal spore diversity in the organic versus the conventional plot. There are differences. I think that's important. I don't know what, we may not know everything about what they mean, but they're different, and we couldn't have done this without these long-term plots. There are some additional new challenges in regulation, in my view, and Craig Pearson, the former dean of Guelph, I think articulated it very well in a recent paper, and asked the question, how regenerative are our cropping systems? And argued for semi-closed systems, as opposed to the linear systems which we have right now. We are very much exporting our nutrients, and they're ending up in another part of the world, and this addresses the issue that our previous speaker alluded to. Let me try to cobble together a story, at least to maybe stimulate some thinking. Organic systems benefit from livestock integration, and so this is our straw-based pig rearing facility at Glenlee, and we have access to this manure. And the manure is not only important for sustaining the system, but it also does interesting things with energy. What we've done recently is to look at the rotations that contain forage and grain under conventional management with pigs and with no pigs, and we're interested in the energy use of those systems. Clearly, putting the pigs in the system reduces our energy, even if it's transported 5 kilometers from the barn. And if we look at the energy required to produce the amount of wheat feedstock produced per megajoule, it's quite a bit higher from that integration. So we have value in integrating crops and livestock. And let me show you an example from Australia which illustrates how to do it properly. This is a long-term rotation study in New South Wales, and the rotation here is maize, spring, oat, red clover, autumn oat, and the autumn oat yields are being shown here. They go up for the first little while. Why is that? And then they go down. Why is that? Well, during this phase, the research station had sheep, and the sheep grazed the clover. And right here, what happened was the clover was hayed because the research center was closed, the sheep were moved off, and they said, let's keep this study, but we'll just hay the clover, and that'll be just as good. Well, it's not as good. And that, unfortunately, is how we conduct all of our integrated agricultural crop livestock experiments in Western Canada. We have very little emphasis on true integration of crop and livestock and the nutrient cycling from a lay system. And that is where I certainly see a gap. Now, I know that the people at USDA and Mandan are doing some of this, and that's good. Let's go one step further. If we're going to get serious about regenerative or semi-closed agriculture, yes, we may not be able to supply enough farmyard manure to the system. Does somebody need help there? Somebody collapsed. Maybe we need a cell phone. Is it okay? Yeah, thank you. Okay, I'm glad you're okay. Don Tanaka, do you want to put up your hand? Yeah, so if anybody wants to learn about that crop livestock integrated system in Mandan, you can talk to Don Tanaka. If we're going to get serious about these semi-closed agricultural systems, we have to get involved as well. Many of the we often criticize cycled agriculture because there's not enough nutrients from animals. Well, what about us? If we look at the cities of Calgary, Edmonton, Winnipeg, the three biggest cities in our region, they produce enough nitrogen to maintain well over 100,000 hectares of wheat. There are issues of odor, biosolid, But are we serious about this or not? I mean, do we want them just to go away? Human urine provides another opportunity for very good regeneration. So we need to, I think, as agronomists, become part of this study and this discussion, and maybe design some studies to look at alternative human waste management streams and how that fits into the food system. And my final slide here, I just wanted to talk a little bit about the way that our work fits into our culture. I mean, how many of you have enjoyed that picture? How many, put up your hands. How many of you, you know, okay, obviously, now you're you know, boring agronomists, so, you know, you don't have a life out, so we didn't expect anything better out of you. We all, you know, if we grew up in a landscape, something like this, we appreciate it. And so society is interested in not only, you know, nutritious food, but aesthetic beauty, places of recreation, places of restorative retreat. And as agronomists, how do we deal with that? Well, I saw an interesting paper yesterday from Iowa State on a remote sensing system to look at a long-term site differently on a landscape scale. And so maybe we should think about establishing long-term trials, monitoring on a landscape scale using that technology. But I just want to leave you with this thought. I've been following the work of Joan Nassauer in University of Michigan for quite a number of years, because in her landscape ecology and perception and design lab, what she does is using computers, simulates landscapes based on different criteria. And she uses the different U.S. Farm Bill scenarios to paint a picture of you know, what the riparian zones will look like and how much trees and how much diversity will be in the landscape and that type of thing. And I think perhaps if we're going to be able to make a meaningful contribution here, we have to talk to people like her and get the landscape ecologists involved. So in conclusion, the value of rotations, well, it's a living lab. The system responds to changes in environment and management, and therefore it evolves. We cannot step twice into the same river, so archiving helps. Archives are very, very important, as the people at Rothamsted know. And the most valuable thing, I asked Henry yesterday morning, what's the most valuable thing about long-term studies? And he said, it allows us to answer questions that we have not yet anticipated. And I think we can agree that that's important. Carbon cycling, climate change, energy, environment, future semi-closed food systems. And with that, I'd like to end and thank you for your attention. Thank you.